these fascinating containers. 83-year-old Madame Dardenne has gathered around 60,000 vintage tin boxes in a span of 30 years. The empty containers of all sizes now occupy four other houses. They once used to hold all kinds of goods, ranging from coffee, biscuits, tobacco, tea and soap to shoe polish, are now piled high all over the building that belongs to Dardenne. Some of these boxes, according to her, come from as far as India and Japan. Dardenne says it all started with a chocolate box that was given to her with a painting of a blonde girl in a blue hat.
I consider this box to be the first of my collection. It is a box of Belgian Côte d'Or chocolates that a relative of my husband gave me, believing that I was interested in boxes.
She sees the boxes as history books with decorations and writings on them describing major events and reflecting contemporary culture. The collection is the largest in the world, listed by the Guinness Book of Records. Located in eastern Belgium, the museum can be visited by appointment. Humans have damaged the environment perhaps more than any other species, but there are always some who go out of their way to help animals in distress. Juan Carlos Rodriguez and his wife run a sloth rescue center in the lush outskirts of the Venezuelan capital, Caracas. They have so far saved over 45 sloths. The couple decided to start helping the furry mammals last year after running into a sloth that had been badly injured. They saved him and called him Chewy, after a character in the popular Star Wars franchise. Juan and his wife are now alone in their life-saving journey. Are not alone in their life-saving journey, as their vet friends also help them with services and donations. The coronavirus pandemic has disrupted lives all around the world, but it's important to try to stay fit for humans and animals alike. Penguins in an open zoo in Thailand have been keeping their daily routines, although no visitors are allowed due to COVID-19 restrictions. They are regularly taken out of their air-conditioned enclosure so they can enjoy a walk or swim. The 41 flightless birds consume nearly 25 kilograms of fresh fish each day. The cute animals at the zoo are aged from 1 month to 18 years old.
South Korean medical workers manning drive-through coronavirus testing centers have a new way to cool off and rest amid hot summer days: recovery buses. The medical workers are now able to enjoy their breaks at these buses, which are equipped with air conditioning, cold water and snacks. The workers are allowed to take off their protective suits that trap heat and create an environment difficult to tolerate. Some of the buses also have shower booths and bunk beds to help the medical workers deal with their hard work. They say the buses are refreshing.
I almost feel like I'm stuck in a heat dome, like in a car with the air conditioner off in the middle of summer. It's so hot that it's even hard to breathe. But when I come here during the break time and rest in a much cooler and more pleasant environment like an igloo, I can recharge and work cheerfully in the afternoon.
These buses were first designed and used as resting places for Korean police officers and firefighters. Now, 22 of them are deployed to testing centers across the country. The government is considering deploying more recovery buses amid rising temperature and a new wave of coronavirus infections.
An aquarium in the French capital, Paris, is celebrating the birth of a baby black-tip shark. The female shark is 55 centimeters long and weighs 560 grams. She's currently quarantined in a small pond so she wouldn't come under attack by adult sharks. Officials at the aquarium say she'll be ready to swim amongst other sharks in 3 to 4 months. She was born last week at the aquarium, an event the caretakers say is very rare.
It's a rare event for us, which hadn't happened here for the past 5 years. The birth is quite rare in aquariums and in captivity in general. In fact, there are often embryos that won't survive, or they're sometimes stillborn. That's what makes it a rare event, which also occurs at night. We had the chance to observe it during the day, which allowed us to intervene very quickly, and we're able to recover the little one.
The International Union for the Conservation of Nature has designated black-tipped sharks as a vulnerable species. It's particularly poached in some countries for their distinctive fins. The marvelous creatures have a torpedo-shaped body and often spin out of water while eating. They have specialized cells in their snouts that detect the electric current of nearby prey.
Mournful is the earth as heaven starts to cry. Water doubts its worth as lips begin to dry. Listen to the silence. It breaks with a sad goodbye. Amid the drums of war is a mother's lullaby. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. I cry for you in pain. I cry for you. I cry for you in
pain. In the limelight.
So far this fiscal year, U.S. Border Patrol personnel have discovered 121 fraudulent vaccination cards, totaling 3,017 false cards, the agency said in a Friday, August 13th statement. The recipients of these cards were said to be all over the U.S. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Laura Enrion, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Tennessee Border Agents Seized Thousands of Counterfeit COVID-19 Vaccination Cards. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. The U.S. Customs and Border Protection officers in Memphis, Tennessee, said it captures hundreds of falsified COVID-19 vaccine cards daily.
So far this fiscal year, U.S. Border Patrol personnel have discovered 121 fraudulent vaccination cards, totaling 3,017 false cards, the agency said in a Friday, August 13th statement. The agency confirmed it found the cards would come in packs of between 20 to 50 and 100 cards without any attempts to conceal them in anything. The counterfeit cards feature the logo of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, and blank lines for filling in information such as names and dates of vaccination. They still have obvious traits of a falsified document, such as typos and misspelled the Spanish wording on the back, and that they were imported by a non-CDC or medical entity. The recipients of these cards were said to be all over the United States of America. These vaccinations are free and available everywhere, said Michael Niepert, Area Port Director of Memphis, adding that the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, already had other burdens to tackle in addition to this new illegal shipment. CBP officers at the Area Port of Memphis remain committed to stopping counterfeit smuggling and helping to protect our communities, he said, adding, but just you know that when you order a fake vax card, you are using my officer's time, as they also seize fentanyl and methamphetamines. According to the FBI, using or commercializing counterfeit vaccine cards equates to unlawful use of a government agency deal such as HHS or CDC, which could result in a potential fine and up to 5 years in prison. Niebert said these vaccinations are free and available everywhere. If you do not wish to receive a vaccine, that is your decision. But don't order a counterfeit, waste my officer's time, break the law, and misrepresent yourself. After more reports from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, suggest how more contagious and lethal the Delta variant could be compared to the original virus that struck the world last year, the White House and other officials had begun increasing their demand that people get the jab. In several places across the U.S., vaccination has become mandatory. People would either lose their employment and be refused public services such as restaurants, theaters, and other indoor enterprises without a vaccine card. While the experimental vaccines were said to be effective in preventing severe illnesses and deaths, especially with the more dangerous Delta variant of COVID-19, not all people are prepared to accept the jabs. The reasons for rejecting them vary from different beliefs, medical complications, and uncertainties about the side effects from the vaccines, to a resistance to having their freedom of choice taken away. Meanwhile, in Florida, the reports that COVID-19 surge is so out of control that if the state were a nation, the U.S. would have to consider banning travel from its residents, warned an infectious disease expert. Infection levels in Florida have risen 51% in the last 7 days, according to data from Johns Hopkins University. The state reported 134,506 new COVID-19 cases from July 30 to August 5th, more than any other 7-day period. The viral load in Florida is so high right now, there are really only two places on the planet where it's higher: Louisiana and Botswana. Dr. Jonathan Rayner, a professor at George Washington School of Medicine and Health Sciences, said on CNN recently, adding, "It's so high in Florida that I think Florida, if it was another country, we would have to consider banning travel from Florida to the United States." Despite the soaring risk, GOP Governor Ron DeSantis is taking no precautions. In fact, DeSantis signed an executive order banning vaccination and mask mandates, including in public schools. He said he wants to allow freedom of choice for parents and like seeing the unmasked faces of smiling children. Some of those parents sued DeSantis, arguing that weak health regulations in Florida schools threaten the safety and lives of their children, denying them the right to an education. Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Gunrunners, directed by Canadian documentary filmmaker Anjali Nayar. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Tete Coffey, who is a journalist and broadcaster. Now, Gunrunners, which is shot over a 10-year period, follows two Kenyan cattle rustlers, who are also known as warriors, Julius Arile and Robert Mutanda, who put their violent past behind them to become marathon runners as part of a government-sponsored program to disarm the conflict-heavy region. We see Arile enter international marathons, while Mutanda gets involved in the political sphere and dreams of working towards policy change. Though, as we see these once notorious warriors given a chance to pursue their dreams, we realize that the road to glory is full of bumps and detours for these charismatic men. Well, first of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, Kenya is known as a destination for world-class marathon runners, but as we see in this documentary, it's not as glamorous as it seems to be a top athlete in that part of the world, particularly because some of them are quite literally running for their lives, running away from crime. And we see that cattle stealing, or cattle wrestling, as it's called, is quite commonplace because that's an important source of income. And this region is also engulfed in the illegal arms trade industry, which is part of a global multi-billion dollar industry. Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, firstly, it's just a fascinating sort of insight into, you know, a situation that I really did not know much about. You know, I know very well that Kenya is a history of producing great runners. I didn't know about this, you know, pretty fantastic government-run program, this sort of amnesty and the disarmament idea, which is a really great one, and obviously gives a great film title then, Gunrunners. The film itself, I mean, I think it was shot over 10 years, so I, you know, you can only imagine how much footage has been accumulated during that time. And I guess, as fascinating as I found the subject and the two principal characters, I felt that in a sort of 90-minute running time, you're kind of skipping big chunks. You know, so much is going on, and I didn't feel that I was getting to know the two men in the way that I would have liked. I mean, basically, I could imagine a longer film that would I would have maybe, you know, it's longer, but you would have felt more in getting into the rhythm of what's going on with these people, because there's so much to say, and they go through so many changes, both of them individually, and I feel 90 minutes doesn't necessarily do justice to everything that's, you know, it's trying to encapsulate.
You're right, it is absolutely jam-packed. It touches on issues of violence, as well as the main themes of sports and running, but then also politics and corruption. There's just so much in this documentary. And Tete, if I could turn to you, what was your take on Gun Runners?
Okay, normally when I'm told about documentaries about Africa, I go, I yawn, roll my eyes and go, oh God, not again. I tend to want to avoid them. I was very pleasantly surprised by this for two reasons. One, it was rich in context. So that whatever was going through the lives of these two, the protagonists, if you like, it was placed within context and it gave you an understanding of the environment from which they came. Secondly, I think it was done with quite a lot of sensitivity. There's little tricks he used in what you call chopping and changing. I mean, cutting from the Rift Valley, training scenes.
Which is absolutely breathtaking.
Exquisite. In Kenya, over to the skyscrapers of New York. You could see that these are two little people operating in one world, but kind of moving out into a much, much bigger world. And the third thing I really liked about it was that it looks as if these two characters are archetypes. And Arili is very much the superstar, the very talented runner and so on. And his mate, Mutanda, seems to be much more the political type. So how the two characters fare was something I was always watching to see. I was impressed.
I'd like to pick apart their characters a bit later on.
Sure.
Maliv, I'd like to ask you, this documentary kind of describes itself as the American Dream, but Kenyan style. It's an interesting analogy. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'm always a bit puzzled by this American Dream. I don't understand why, you know, one country has a monopoly on wanting to change your life for the better and improve your situation. I mean, it's a cute tagline. I think it's kind of irrelevant. The fact is, yes, they do go to New York and, you know, run marathons there. But, you know, marathon running is a world global pursuit. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, to me, it smacks more of marketing than any sort of reality. Why can't it be a Kenyan dream?
Annual Tekla Lorupe Peace Race. Tekla Lorupe, the former marathon world record holder from the conflict region, is partnering with the government to invite cattle rustlers to trade in their weapons in exchange for amnesty and a chance to win cows and cash prizes.
As in Lagos, there's 3 I heard about Tekla.
From this film that this amnesty program is quite inspirational. How does it transform the lives of Arili and Mutanda, Lee?
Well, I mean, you know, until this program comes in, they are very aware that they're living a very precarious, you know, highly dangerous existence, and one that they're very clearly both uncomfortable with. You know, it does involve, they don't answer it directly, but you very much get the sense that they've been involved in deaths. And obviously they've had loved ones or friends die as well. So it's just a really unpleasant, you know, precarious existence. So this government program is really trying to give people a kind of a firmer foothold in, I guess, you know, quote unquote, the right direction. So taking them away from sort of illegal activities, illegal guns, and trying to sort of, you know, push their energies and their sort of, their outlook in a more kind of positive and, peaceful direction. So that's a great thing.
And Tete, the film sheds a positive light on this amnesty program. How effective is it really, and can you talk more a bit about this?
Well, there are a couple of things which come out. For a program to work, you've got to be able to transfer skills which are being adversely used or not constructively used into something which is positive. And in the way the story pans out with these two characters, Mutanda is very much the organizer. I mean, he had 500... effectively gangsters, hoodlums, they call themselves rustlers, under his charge. And this guy's a people organizer. Of course, he's the one whose skills are now deployed in the political arena, actually getting people involved with the program, even campaigning for a parliamentary candidate. And he says he himself has parliamentary aspirations. Then Arili, on the other hand, is the rising star, the, the hugely talented individual. They said that even as a kid he was winning things at kind of at the local level. So his skills, his competitive drive is now being, you know, applied in an arena which can actually make him money, improve the quality of his personal life, the life of his family, and so on. And it does say that a lot depends on the quality of government, the environment you provide. These talents are available in bad neighborhoods, and they're available in the right postcodes. The difference is that in the right postcode or a stable environment, those talents are able to flourish because they are positively deployed. So in terms of this gun amnesty, Kenya had a problem. I think it was a blindingly inspired idea. It's one of the funniest quotes I actually picked up from this was he said, well, the skills I need to run, I need to be able to run fast to chase cattle, and I need to be run fast to escape the police. And he's doing that in a marathon.
That's exactly the point of this film, is that violence goes hand in hand with their ability to be good athletes. Yeah. And Leif, if I could ask you, an issue that is raised in this documentary is that when you have a gun, you have a sense of power. So it seems as if it's an accepted reality or part of life in Kenya.
There's an amazing quote, and to be honest, it's the thing that probably stayed with me most from this film. I think it's Mutanda he's talking. He's like, you know, if you haven't killed someone, if you haven't stolen their property, then what kind of a warrior are you? And to me, this is really then what they're actually really trying to do underline is change the whole paradigm of what makes a warrior or actually a man. And actually, that's something that is a huge, that's not just particular to this country. It's something we probably all need to look at in, you know, different societies, the way we construct masculine identity. And it shouldn't be about trying to dominate and power and, you know, impose yourself. And I think actually they don't explore that anymore, sadly, I felt in this. Mm. But the fact that he vocalizes it shows that actually it's making him reconsider what, you know, as a warrior he should be doing. And then the fact that he goes into more sort of, you know, political and sort of socially constructive things is obviously helping that situation.
So I know you'd like to jump in, but we're just going to pause just for a second as we take a look at another clip from Gun Runners, which shows Robert Mutanda tell us about the significance of marathon running.
In the bush, I used to run. That's why when I came here, I didn't find it difficult when I started to run, because I was running even 100 kilometers. You know, when the police is chasing you, also you chase the cattle, so you chase very fast. But if you chase very slowly, the police will capture you, and then you will be in a hot soup. Look outside, the people are running. Town breathes, eats, sleeps, imagines, fantasizes, athletics. The odds 1 out of 10 that you can make money out of it. And 1 in 50 to really make money out of it and start really changing your life. The luck of getting a manager that supports you and brings you to races for around a 15% commission is crucial. There is a big boulevard of broken dreams here in India. A big one, a big, big, big one. But some people walk over the boulevard of broken dreams, still thinking they can make it.
I found both characters to be quite endearing, but I think Mutanda was the more charismatic one out of the two. And we get the sense that he had a much darker past than Relay. There was a moment when he was asked how many people he's killed, and he just looks off camera and remains silent, which is quite chilling to watch. Leif, what did you make of Mutanda's character compared to Relay's?
Yeah, I mean, one of the strengths of the film is that they are very different. So you have that immediate contrast. And Tete's, you know, described it very well. Mutanda's the sort of more social, you know, political animal. He has a natural ability and affinity to kind of, you know, draw people in. Relay is much more kind of, you know, quieter, more sort of focused on his own sort of goals. And so that, I think, is one of the main strengths of the film, because as you follow their paths, you find that actually they diverge more than you might expect, because actually they aren't equally talented runners. So then one storyline really pursues the actual running side of it, and the other goes, I would say, into equally or maybe more interesting avenues about, well, if you can't do that, it's not just, you know, guns or running. Actually, if the running is not going to be your career, you can use your skills in different ways, and I think that's a very interesting.
And we see Mutanda pursue politics. But then, of course, we learned that it seems to be a corrupt world, and it's almost he embraces it and talks about it openly. Tete, is this a reality of life in Kenya?
It's a reality of life in Kenya, and not just Kenya, a lot of African countries. It's also the reality of life over here, but it's because there's a lot more wealth, and because ordinary people's needs are taken care of on a day-to-day basis, you don't see it as starkly. But in Kenya, it's very clear. I mean, he threatens the politician that if you don't make me, you know, minister in charge of security, which he patently won't be able to hold, he wouldn't be able to hold that position. He said he'd mobilize things against him. But what it says to me is that these individual talents are kind of drawn into this prism of organization, be it the sport, be it politics, be it whatever. And it is the quality of the organization that can absolutely, you know, enable them or absolutely destroy them.
And I want to touch quickly on the point about guns. We find out in this documentary also that there's 500,000 illegal guns in Kenya. I mean, where are they coming from and why are they there?
Well, I mean, there was a breakup of the Soviet Union, and that led to a huge kind of splurge of small arms all over the world. And, of course, these things are what are required to create kind of little lordships in all of these different countries. And it is one of the saddest statistics of African life that is that where there are the greatest resources, you have the greatest conflict. So a country like the Congo, which is incredibly wealthy, has had internecine strife for near on 40 years consecutively. Of course, while that happens, the natives can't benefit from the resources in their land, but other agents do. And unfortunately, it is often foreign agents who enable these weapons to get into the hands of these people. And so that it's almost a system of divide and rule. But of course, you know, if you're a politician in Africa and you're accepting bribes from foreign agents to create conflict and strife in your own country, that's a decision only you can make. Nobody holds a gun to your head to do that. So it comes to issues around personal integrity and so on and so forth.
That's a really interesting point, but I'm afraid we'll have to move on just for the time being.
My name is Julius Arile from Kenya. 6 years ago, being a warrior, fighting with another people from our country. But this time now, I am an athlete, and I can run a marathon.
He really does need to make a breakthrough. And if he doesn't have it, then it's going to be harder to fulfill this kind of dream of being in New York as an elite, top elite athlete that could maybe make it in the top five.
Good morning and welcome to Prague, Czech Republic, for the 19th running of the Volkswagen Prague Marathon.
A great race starting in Prague's old town square in this historic city.
So really is very much the underdog character in this documentary, and you really find yourself rooting for him. He has a lot of pressure on himself to prove himself, and he dreams of being on the wall, as he says, of all the top runners of Kenya. And we see him come seventh place in the first race, but then do really well in the second opportunity he has. What did you make of this sort of triumphant arc he had?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess when you're choosing your characters to focus on at the beginning of a journey, you have no idea, actually, are they going to make it? So I think it's less, it sounds a cliche, but it's less about the destination than the journey. It's fascinating to follow this particular man on his sort of athletics career. Now, if he, you know, ends up winning a gold medal at the Olympics, even more extraordinary. But actually, I find it more interesting when you see the real struggles and the person who isn't necessarily going to be the ultimate victor in this. The film really made me think about an American documentary called Hoop Dreams from the 1990s, which followed two young inner-city kids who wanted to be basketball stars. Now, neither of them end up making it, but what you get is a fascinating portrait of their environment and the world that they're in and the politics and the social disadvantages. And actually, that's a more illuminating and, I think, more fascinating storyline than just, you know, the underdog who comes from nowhere to, you know, in the last minute, you know, storms to the front and wins the medal. That's interesting, but I'm more interested in the sort of the world that they're, that shapes their, you know.
Of course, he's plagued by poverty and injuries and not the same opportunities. Tete, are you agreeing with Lee there?
Absolutely, the journey's fascinating. And none of these characters are pristine. A relay got somebody pregnant when she was quite young. It led to her suicide and led to him becoming a warrior. But later on, he's now got three wives and children by all of them. So if he's not able to take that, put each one of his problems in some kind of compartment, he won't be able to pursue his dream. So these dreams are always fraught. And actually, the story, as you say very well, is the compromises, you know, the calls that each person has to make to pursue what it is that they're really after, and an illumination of the environment within which all of this is going on.
I want to talk now about the parallels we see between Kenya and the US, sort of the Western world. Lee, what did you make of their journey, of Relay's journey to New York, and sort of the observations and comments he was making?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's very much sort of fish out of water stuff, right? So, you know, where they've grown up, where they live, what they're used to is obviously a world away from, you know, the slightly, you know, more glamorous, the more professional, the more kind of money at stake world that they go into. But I think, again, what's really interesting is in their own world as well, you see the way that they're not quite fitting in and the problems that they have. And to be honest, I would have liked the film to touch more on that. Like Tete says, they have these very checkered family lives. That's not really grappled with in the way that I would have, you know, appreciated a bit more. And I feel that, you know, of course the thread is the running and the marathon and what happens, but actually to get to know them even a bit more as characters and get a sort of a more rounded portrait of them, I would have liked to hear more about those sort of difficulties with the families and the wives and the kids, because it obviously has an impact. He wants to earn money so he can go back and provide for them, but we don't necessarily get, you know, the full story about what that entails.
And Tete, isn't it quite sad, though, that this notion of success, we see Arile move to sort of a shack-like accommodation, and he thinks he's living in a European city. Why is that this connection of success is linked to Europe and the West?
Well, success is always relative to what you've got. I mean, this guy wasn't having three baths a week out in the bush, and he's suddenly in a shack with running water. I mean, that's luxury. You might as well, from his point of view, be at the Ritz Hotel. It's absolutely relative. But what I think it's important for people to also think about is the fact that this can be quite corrupting. This kind of drive to live in that star-spangled environment can be quite corrupting, because we all know that the industry that he's now becoming a part of, the elite athletics industry, is also incredibly corrupt.
Which is mainly dominated, sort of, as we see, by Western physiotherapists and management types.
So it's incredibly corrupt. So it's really a story about how, you know, man has to try and make it, making moral judgments at every turn of the way in a not-so-easy world.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
Mournful is the earth as heaven starts to cry. wrapped its world as lips begin to dry. Listen to the silence. It breaks with a sad goodbye. Amid the drums of war is a mother's lullaby. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. I cry for you in pain. I cry for you. I cry for you in
pain. In the limelight.
Germany added the United States to its high-risk area list and will soon tighten entry restrictions for unvaccinated travelers who had recently been in the United States. Starting Sunday, 15th of August, travelers who have recently spent time in the U.S. will need to be fully vaccinated or demonstrate an important reason for entering Germany. Those who are unvaccinated or unable to show proof of recovery will need to self-isolate for 10 days upon arrival. The quarantine period can end on the fifth day with proof of a negative COVID-19 test. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist Bailey Schultz, writing for USA Today. The piece is titled, Germany Tightens Travel Restrictions on U.S. as COVID-19 Cases Surge. Germany added the United States to its high-risk area list and will soon tighten entry restrictions for unvaccinated travelers who had recently been in the U.S. Starting Sunday, 15th of August, travelers who have recently spent time in the U.S. will need to be fully vaccinated or demonstrate an important reason for entering Germany. Those who are unvaccinated or unable to show proof of recovery will need to self-isolate for 10 days upon arrival. The quarantine period can end on the fifth day with proof of a negative COVID-19 test. Previously, unvaccinated travelers had to show a negative coronavirus test to enter Germany. The change comes as the U.S. faces its fourth wave of COVID-19, driven by the highly contagious Delta variant. The country reported more than 900,000 new COVID cases in the past week, and nearly 52% of its population vaccinated, according to data from Johns Hopkins University. Turkey and Vietnam and other countries were also added to Germany's high-risk list, joining destinations like the United Kingdom, Spain, India, and Mexico. Germany has been open to tourists from the United States since 20th of June, shortly after the European Union added the United States to a list of countries it believed could see the gradual lifting of travel restrictions. The recommendation is not binding, and each country in the European bloc can enforce its own travel restrictions. The European Union has yet to remove the United States from its safe travel list, despite the US maintaining a travel ban on most European countries. Restrictions against the European Schengen area were first implemented in March of 2020 and prevent travel to the United States for most people from major European countries such as France, Germany, Italy, Greece, Netherlands, Belgium, Denmark, Austria, Sweden, Norway, Hungary, and others. German Chancellor Angela Merkel pressed President Joe Biden on the travel ban during a meeting last month. Biden said at the time that his team was reviewing the travel restrictions, but no changes have been made. The administration certainly understands the importance of international travel. Jeff Zients, White House COVID-19 response team coordinator, said during a press briefing last week. But given the prevalence of the Delta variant of the coronavirus, the United States will maintain the existing travel restrictions at this point. Meanwhile, the United States has no plans to lift travel restrictions for travelers arriving from Europe. The decision means the country's current travel restrictions, which deny entry for people from the European Schengen area, as well as people from the United Kingdom and other countries, will remain in place. Given where we are today with the Delta variant, we will maintain existing travel restrictions at this point for a few reasons, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said at a recent press briefing. Jen Psaki added, "The more transmissible Delta variant is spreading both here and around the world. Driven by the Delta variant, cases are rising here at home, particularly among those who are unvaccinated, and appear likely to continue in the weeks ahead." When asked if President Biden would drop travel restrictions in the event airlines adopted vaccine passports or vaccine mandates, Jen Psaki said on Friday, "There are ongoing working groups focused on how to reopen international travel into the United States. There are a range of topics in those discussions that are ongoing," Jen Psaki added. "The president receives regular briefings on them, but we rely on public health and medical advice on when we're going to determine changes to be made." Travel industry groups have urged the Biden administration to open international travel. The Delta variant of the coronavirus now accounts for about 83% of cases nationwide and has led to a spike in U.S. COVID-19 cases. In the last 2 weeks, cases have increased 171% nationally, and the death rate is up 19% over the week before.
Venezuela's government and the opposition began a new round of talks to end a years-long political impasse and economic crisis in the Latin American country on Friday in Mexico City. The two sides signed a memorandum of understanding containing the roadmap that will guide the dialogue process. The dialogue is mediated by Norway and hosted by the Mexican government. The government of President Nicolas Maduro has called for the lifting of the sanctions imposed by the United States and Europe against Venezuelan officials and institutions. On the other hand, the opposition has demanded the government to release dozens of people it considers as political prisoners and provide guarantees that they can run in the regional elections due in November. In addition, they have requested the government to allow humanitarian aid, including COVID-19 vaccines, to enter the country. In 2019, the Venezuelan government abandoned talks that took place in Barbados and Norway after the U.S. stepped up sanctions against the Maduro administration. In 2016, the Vatican supported similar talks that also failed. Furthermore, the plan for recent talks ran into trouble when the government rejected one of the opposition's envoys. Representatives of President Maduro refused to take part in the meeting if the opposition leader Juan Guaido's ambassador to Washington remained on the delegation. Venezuela says the U.S. sanctions are responsible for the country's current economic crisis.
That is the number one issue facing Venezuelans, because the sanctions are designed to break the Venezuelan economy and cause hunger on a mass scale. So if that can be challenged and pushed back even by a small bit, that would be incredibly important for all Venezuelan people. So I think these are fair parameters to go into the negotiations with. These are fair conditions, and the fact that the opposition is now coming to the negotiating table is a sign that they haven't got too many other options. This is, you know, after 2 years of trying to launch coups, calling for invasions, that they're now looking at the peaceful route is enormously positive, I think.
Washington and several of its Western allies have backed opposition leader Juan Guaido and imposed crippling sanctions on Venezuela in a bid to oust President Nicolas Maduro. The government says it won't bow down to what it calls blackmail by the United States in the upcoming talks. Venezuela descended into political turmoil after opposition figure Juan Guaido unilaterally declared himself as the interim president in January 2019. He claimed that Maduro's re-election in 2018 was fraudulent. The Trump administration recognized Guaido as the legitimate leader of Venezuela and publicly pursued a regime change policy against Maduro. Meanwhile, the Biden administration has reaffirmed the U.S. recognition of Guaido as interim president and has ruled out negotiations with Maduro anytime soon. The United States has refrained from recognizing Nicolas Maduro's re-election in 2018, frozen millions of dollars of Venezuelan money in U.S. bank accounts, and imposed sanctions on the crisis-hit economy of the Latin American nation. In what has been termed economic terrorism, Washington is attempting to use sanctions as leverage to overthrow the legitimate government of Maduro, while freezing assets and slapping illegal sanctions on countries that refuse to submit to Washington's hegemonic policies is nothing new. The U.S. sanctions have directly targeted Venezuelan people, who are stuck between the coronavirus pandemic and an economic crisis. Experts say the sanctions, used as a tool for regime change, have no effect on the stability of Maduro administration, but impact the socioeconomic condition of ordinary people amidst the COVID-19 crisis.
Fierce clashes have been ongoing in recent weeks between Afghan government forces and the Taliban militant group. But the government troops haven't been able to keep the Taliban from making rapid advances across the country. In the past few weeks, the militant group has managed to capture half of the provincial capitals in Afghanistan, including the country's second largest city, Kandahar. According to estimates, the group is now in control of nearly two-thirds of the country.
Nobody with 75,000 troops or 100,000 troops can take over a whole country with practically no resistance, and thousands and thousands and thousands of your so-called enemy just surrendering and saying, here, take the weapons, unless they have some kind of meaningful political support. So whatever has happened in Afghanistan over these years, we're not back at ground zero. There is a change in the political climate in the country.
U.S. intelligence officials are reportedly predicting that the Afghan capital, Kabul, will be isolated in a month and will be taken over in a matter of 90 days. In the meantime, the United States and Britain have urged their nationals to immediately leave Afghanistan, with Washington announcing it's temporarily deploying 3,000 U.S. troops to Kabul to help evacuate American citizens and diplomatic staff. The advances of the Taliban have led the Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani, to replace the country's army chief. The United Nations Secretary General has called on the Taliban militants to halt their offensive in Afghanistan.
I call on the Taliban to immediately halt the offensive and to negotiate in good faith in the interest of Afghanistan and its people. I hope that discussions in Doha, Qatar, between representatives of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan and the Taliban, supported by the region and the wider international community, will restore the best way to a negotiated settlement to the conflict.
Guterres warned that, quote, Afghanistan is spinning out of control. He told the reporters that seizing power through military force is a losing proposition that can only lead to prolonged civil war or the complete isolation of the country. He expressed concern over the early indications that the Taliban are imposing severe restrictions on human rights in the areas under their control. Guterres called on all parties to do more to protect civilians. His comments come as thousands of civilians are fleeing the violence across the country and seeking refuge in Kabul. The country's healthcare is also in bad shape, with health workers becoming overwhelmed as the number of people requiring medical attention has been on the rise. The U.S. is poised to withdraw all its combat troops from Afghanistan, ending its longest war in history by September 11th. That's despite the opposition from many American politicians who are saying it's doing so hastily.
We are doing what the British did for 100 years, trying to play these various peoples and games one out off against each other, maintain Iran as the enemy, use Israel as our sort of fer de lance in the Middle East, support regimes from the 12th century, like Saudi Arabia. So sure, we hope Afghanistan becomes everybody else's problem.
The fact that the Taliban are seizing Afghan cities even before U.S. troops have officially left the country clearly shows that all funds the U.S. spent and all lives lost during the 20 years were for nothing.
The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Khamenei, has highlighted the unreliability of foreign providers of COVID vaccines to Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei said foreign providers of the vaccines initially reneged on their promises and refused sales. But things began to change course after Iran successfully managed to produce jabs against the deadly virus at home. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks during a televised speech on Wednesday amid a deadly pandemic wave that has gripped the country. Fortunately, the production of vaccines within the country paved the path for the import of foreign shots as well. Whereas before that, foreign suppliers would renege on their promises despite having received the payments. The leader called on the executive bodies to double their efforts to procure vaccines, whether imported or domestically developed, and made them available to everyone.
We always have to look to the source of problems in the Middle East, and that is usually either the United States or Israel. In this case, I think we can see, or say fairly safely, that the United States is pressuring other countries not to sell vaccines to Iran in order to pressure Iran to re-enter the JCPOA. This is going to be a failed strategy, another failed strategy by the United States, which has never understood people's loyalty to their own government and has tried to bribe or intimidate countries to do the United States' bidding.
Ayatollah Khamenei hailed an initiative by President Ebrahim Raisi to set a one-week deadline for proposals on a comprehensive national response to the current peak of the outbreak. He said the response to the issue should be carefully weighed and any necessary measures adopted and enforced accordingly.
This is another example of that. By preventing other countries from selling vaccines to Iran, U.S. hopes that Iran will agree to concessions to rejoin the JCPOA. This simply isn't going to happen.
Iran is one of the few countries which has been able to produce vaccines against the deadly COVID virus. After a year of intensive research using all internal resources and expertise, Iran joined the handful of countries that produced the coronavirus vaccine. The Ministry of Health later approved the Coviran Barakat vaccine that was jointly developed by Barakat Pharmaceutical Group and Shifa Pharmed Industrial Group. Iran's flagship coronavirus vaccine has hit a production milestone of 5 million doses nearly a month after it was approved for emergency use in the country. Iran has accelerated its inoculation drive against the coronavirus since earlier this month, after the health ministry announced that it can rely on abundant supplies of foreign jabs, as well as regular deliveries of vaccines that are being manufactured inside of Iran. The government says that it is determined to launch the production lot of domestic jabs, but stresses that vaccines must be imported from other countries to save people's lives. Knowledge-based companies, and especially those active in nanotechnology, are playing a major role in helping the vaccine production companies.
This is definitely an example of that, where U.S. sanctions once again have injured innocent people